This show furnished by Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn.
It's time for Gervy's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervy. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality, and television host, Kerry Kasem. Kerry brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gervy and Kerry Kasem.
Good afternoon, Los Angeles, and everyone listening all over the world on KBC.com. I am Alan Gervy, the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn. And today, as usual, I am live right here in Los Angeles to be the managing partner of your life. And typically, I would be introducing my beautiful and talented and intelligent co-host, Kerry Kasem, who would also be live right here in Los Angeles to be the co-managing partner of your life. But I have to say hello from Las Vegas, live, Kerry Kasem.
Hi, Alan. Yes, I'm actually in Las Vegas. I'm staring at David Copperfield right now. I just got finished watching Ben Vereen, which is the most beautiful stage show I've ever seen.
Ben Vereen. You know, Kerry, I got to interrupt you here for a second. You know, for 7 years, you always blast all of these callers who call into the show because they have crappy lines, crappy phone lines. Where are you calling from? Are you in one of David Copperfield's illusions?
He has me in one of these, like, I don't know what they are, these boxes, and he's sawing my legs off.
As long as he's not sawing your head off.
Oh, no, is it really bad? I tried to go to it. Renee, our screener, said it was a good place.
You sound like you're doing the Houdini water chamber torture illusion.
Terrible. Oh, no.
Garble.
I'll keep walking.
That you've got such a beautiful voice, and all I hear is garble, garble. Anyway, what the heck are you doing in Vegas?
I came to do some oxygen water therapy. And it's been absolutely fantastic.
Water therapy. So why didn't you come out of the water tank to talk to me?
Oh, no. Is this better? Oh, come on. I'm walking.
You know, if you were in studio with me, you would just be going crazy. So how's the therapy going? Are you all cured?
And it's fantastic. It's absolutely fantastic. I'm getting there. You know, because I was diagnosed with Bartonella Babesia, which is kind of like a strain of Lyme disease. And it's getting better, yes.
Fantastic. Well, I'm glad you're talking about a medical condition, because today's show you'll be able to talk to the main doctor in Canada, the guru of medicine, Brian Goldman. So you're going to be able to talk to him about all of your problems. You can kvetch to him all you want. But I got to tell you, you missed a great event last night. We had the Brent Shapiro Foundation gala event with Robert Shapiro, a guest of our show. And there were a lot of former guests of our show there. I spent some time with Gloria Allred. Of course, she's always there. And Patty Glazer was there. And Arya Feruzmond, who started Biz Council, was there. A lot of celebrities. We did the red carpet. I can't do the red carpet as effectively without you. I didn't have my princess standing beside me, although my wife Nancy, who is a princess, was there, but not on the red carpet with me. And you missed it, Kerry.
I was so jealous. It looked like so much fun, and you guys looked great.
Thanks.
You're absolutely great on the red carpet.
And Genevieve did a wonderful job, and her sister Henrietta, but it was for a great cause. It was such a joy to watch the scholarships being given out. Of course, the Brent Shapiro Foundation for the Prevention of Drug Addiction and Dependency, and there was so much money raised to help the youth of this country to make sure that the message gets out there, the education. It's a great event, and I take my hat off to Robert Shapiro and the gang who put together such a wonderful event. And we got to move on, though, Kerry, because we have Brian Goldman waiting. I want to introduce Brian Goldman, even if you're trying to watch the Emmys right now, Kerry, but try to focus, because this is one of your topics. You love medicine. You love,
I know.
You love the welfare, good health and welfare. And we're going to talk today right here on Gervy's Law to a medical journalist, a writer, a broadcaster, public speaker, a personality, radio personality. He's written 3 books, best-selling books, The Power of Kindness, Why Empathy is Essential in Everyday Life. That's his most recent book. Secret Language of Doctors, Cracking the Code of Hospital Culture. The Night Shift, Real Life in the Heart of the ER. And he is a professional emergency room physician at Mount Sinai Hospital in Toronto. He's the host of the CBC radio show, White Coat, Black Art, which has been very successful in an award-winning show on medicine, Behind the Scenes. He's got the Dr. Brian's blog, and he's got an amazing TED Talk. If you haven't seen it, it's almost got 1 million viewers. If you watch it, we'll get him up over 1 million viewers. It's called Doctors Make Mistakes. Can we talk about that? It's been featured in the Huffington Post, NPR's Talk TED Radio Hour. Dr. Brian Goldman, welcome to Gervie's Law.
Alan, it is a pleasure to, with an introduction like that, how could I not be pleased to be talking to you?
No one told you in Canada that I am the king of introductions, and the question that I always ask when I detail an accomplished guy like you who's done such great work and so many people love what you have to say, opening up the eyes of not only Canada but the whole world, tell me, Brian, what are you most proud of?
I'm most proud of my partner Tamara and my kids Sasha and Kaylee. They are my pride and joy. They're the 3 people who make me sane, who allow me to do all the things that you just listed and support me all the way, and I love them dearly. So yeah, I can talk about all the other stuff, but I want to get first things first, Alan.
You know, Carrie, I know you love that answer because yeah. You always talk about family first and then accomplishment mm-hmm. second. But what you've accomplished, Brian, when we talk about all of the different ventures that you've been involved with, and it dates back to getting into medical school, being an obsessive guy. You talk about it in your TED Talk that Brian Goldman would study for a blood test. Do you think you've been able to accomplish all that you have because of your passion, your obsession, passion for compassion? What is it that gives you the energy to do what you're doing?
You know, Alan, it starts with hard work, and I think, you know, when I didn't say that I'd study for a blood test. It was somebody in my grade 11 class at high school who said, you know, that Brian Goldman would study for a blood test. And you know what? I was embarrassed by that when I heard it, but it took years and probably a bit of therapy to look back, and now I kind of giggle every time I think of it because I think it's actually a very endearing thing. It was somebody who just admired that I like to work hard. So I think a lot of it has to do with hard work, and I think a lot of it has to do with if I can get a bit metaphysical. I think I've got an old soul, and I think that I've kind of been around the track a few times. I've had a few lives, and somehow I think I'm on a mission right now to make every minute of my time on Earth count. And part of that is just trying to find the truth in everything. You know, whether it's seeing somebody who's in the midst of the opioid crisis, you know, in the emergency department, or, you know, whether it's trying to unpack an issue in healthcare like shame, you know, which is I think is a huge issue when it comes to try to figure out why people like me who work in healthcare find it so difficult to talk about their mistakes. And the books that I write as well. I just want to get at the truth. And whatever it is, warts and all, because I actually believe that when people speak the truth, that they feel better and they're seen as more authentic. And certainly our Prime Minister, Trudeau, right now is having to speak the truth right now as we speak, talking about, you know, why he might have appeared in videos, you know, a long time ago with brown face and black face, and now trying to explain that to a country that is deciding whether or not he deserves another term as Prime Minister.
Now, he's being forced to tell the truth and to say, I'm sorry, I didn't realize at the time that it was offensive to some. Why can't doctors do that? When we talk about your TED Talk, Doctors Make Mistakes, is it because of a certain insecurity that people have to talk about their mistakes, or is it an ego? What is it? What fear is it that people cannot acknowledge that maybe they're not invincible?
Well, Alan, let me start by saying that I haven't met a physician, a paramedic, a social worker, a nurse, a pharmacist, who's made a mistake, who wouldn't give up several years of their life to be able to undo it. It's not because they don't care. They care a great deal. You know, we've heard there are, you know, growing rates of burnout amongst health professionals, and especially young people. We're talking about medical students and residents. If they make a mistake, it scars them for life. And that's not to take anything away from the people who are the true victims of medical errors, and that is the patients and their families who are either left to pick up the pieces or try to put their lives back together after someone they know and love has died. But so what is the core? What's the issue? What makes it easier in other areas like industry? You know, when you make a movie in Hollywood, if it bombs, well, you've always got the next movie. And I guess they say it's not rocket science or it's not brain surgery. Nobody died. So people die, of course, from medical errors, or they're horribly scarred, or they suffer terrible injuries. And you know, I would say that the core issue affecting many doctors, and it certainly affected me, is this feeling of being shame prone. And it's a word that you know, Dr. Brené Brown has talked about, her latest bestseller, Dare to Lead, but it's something you never hear in medicine. And you know, when I say shame, I don't mean guilt. I don't mean feeling bad about what you did. You know, I did bad, because when you feel guilty, you want to repair it. When you feel shame, it's not I did bad, it's I am bad. And as Brené Brown would say, you feel as if you're unworthy of belonging to the group. You're unworthy of love and acceptance. And so you want to keep it quiet because you're terrified that it's going to be discovered, and when it does, you will be revealed as somebody who deserves to be removed from the group. And we're talking about people, you know, health professionals who are perfectionistic. It might be the only mistake they've ever made, and they are hyper vigilant about making mistakes, as I became hyper vigilant. And the problem, though, with that shame point of view is that you don't share your mistakes with others.
Right.
It's not like the airline industry, where they have anonymous lines, and, you know, the National Transportation Safety Board, they have a hotline where pilots can report difficulties that they had with a landing or a takeoff. We would not have known about the Supermax 737 scandal if that hadn't happened. And we don't have that in medicine. And
right. So
we're not making healthcare as safe as we could, as quickly as we could. You know, on White Coat Black Art, I had the pleasure. Go ahead, Carrie. You had something you wanted to ask?
Yeah, I do. I do. What about peer review? What about the fact
Carrie,
that that's actually taken seriously?
Peer review is important. We're going to have to talk about it after the break because, you know, it's fascinating. We're talking about these issues that I think are even expanded beyond medicine. When we talk about mauvais foi, Sartre talked about mauvais foi, bad faith. As human beings, we walk around, we're afraid. It gets to the core of who we are. If we expose ourselves, if we're seeing without our clothes on, so to speak, in a metaphysical sense, we can talk about that. We can talk about checks and balances, but we can only talk about it after the break. We're talking to Brian Goldman right here on Gervie's Law and Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Talk to my
Dr. Brian Goldman is on the line. You're listening to Gervie's Law. Carrie Kasem has learned so much about being a lawyer doing this show. She isn't one. She just plays one on the radio. Carrie, you are cross-examining Dr. Brian Goldman, emergency physician in Toronto at the Mount Sinai Hospital, host of CBC Radio's White Coat Black Art. Go ahead. Talk about peer review and how that impacts someone's mistakes and the effectiveness of their practice.
Yes, so it's very interesting to me because I've heard so many doctors here in Los Angeles, in the States, say, you know, there's times where doctors make mistakes, there's peer reviews, but nothing's done. And it's very frustrating for them. I have kind of a twofold question, but that's the first part.
So, Carrie, you know, you're asking a great question, and I can answer this in two ways. First of all, I'm actually a peer assessor with, you know, the equivalent of the state medical board in Ontario, Canada. We call this the College of Physicians and Surgeons. And you know, peer, this is a random audit. And what it is basically a chart review, and we're trying to see if the, in my case, if my fellow emergency physicians are, you know, up to speed when it comes to treating asthma, treating headaches, treating low back pain, abdominal pain, gynecological problems. And you know, that's helpful, and there's some evidence to show that, that the better peer review, the better you do on peer review, the fewer mistakes you make. But the problem is that medicine is complex, and it's getting increasingly complex, and you know, the technology is not getting up to speed, you know, quick enough. Artificial intelligence, electronic health records, you know, these things are supposed to make things better. They often make things worse, and so what happens is that in a complicated system with patients who are not well maintained like airplanes, you know, it's not they're not coming off the assembly line like from the Ford Motor Company, and the result is that physicians being human, they're not going to be able to keep all the balls in the air. They're not going to be able to stay on top of every little detail. You never know when the next drug they're going to prescribe, the next medication, is going to interact badly with one or two of the other, of the 12 or 13 other medications the patient's taking. And I don't think that medicine, medical culture, has caught up to the fact that things are getting a lot more complex. And that means we're actually, even though things are better, you know, oncologists, cancer specialists, surgeons can save lives like never before or prolong lives, but it's more complex. And the more complex it is, the more errors are going to take place. And so what we need to do is move from a system that shames people from making mistakes, which discourages them from talking about it, into shifting into one where they talk about mistakes all the time and are continuously improving themselves.
I think you also have to bring to the equation, at least here in California, the costs of the medical treatment that's being provided, because I see it every day in my practice through utilization review, independent medical review, and it's hardly objective when we look at some of the treatment requests or some of the treatment that is going on. It comes down to cost, especially when insurance companies are involved. And I know in Canada there's a different system with OHIP and the Medicare system in Canada versus here. But I'll tell you, Brian, when you look at the decisions that are made, when other reviewers review what certain doctors have done, it comes down to saving money, and that's a shame. That's where the shame comes in. We've got to bring Thomas on the line because I think he wants to talk about peers too. Thomas, you're in Culver City. What do you have to say to the good doctor?
Hey, Dr. Goldman. I was just calling.
Hey, Thomas.
I was just calling to see what was your, after you came out with this book, how did your peers in the hospital, and not only the hospital that you work for, how did they look at you differently after this book came out? Like whenever you exposed some things about the business, like how did they portray you now? Like, oh, I should try to be careful what I say around him? Or did you find yourself kind of saying, oh, I think I might have hurt myself with this work group, this doctors, physicians group? And then my second question is, how much were you pressured as a ER physician to actually admit people, to make them seem sicker, to boost revenue for the hospital?
So those are two great questions. As Alan's already said, Thomas, I work in the Canadian system. There's no pressure to admit people for financial reasons. If anything, you know, one of the big differences between Canadian healthcare and American healthcare, there's many of them, but one of the big ones is that because we have one publicly funded system, everybody has pretty much equal access to care, you know, whether it's an MRI or a CT scan or hip replacements or cataract operations or what have you. The problem, though, is that the lineups are longer. And so there's actually pressure to discharge people as quickly as possible because they're tying up a bed. And one of the biggest problems we have right now in Canada is that we have nursing home patients who are occupying beds that are for acute patients who are having strokes and heart attacks, but they're waiting for a nursing home bed to open up and there just aren't enough of them. So it's actually the opposite. We have no pressure to admit for financial reasons, Thomas. Now, let me answer the other question which you asked, which what was the reaction to my TED Talk and what was the reaction to my books? The Power of Kindness has been received very well, basically because I'm talking about empathy and kindness. And, you know, my publisher said, don't write a book about empathy in healthcare because we're sure you're going to write a negative expose about how unempathetic and unkind doctors are. And in fact, you know, when I give speeches, I talk about that. I talk about the pressures doctors are under, the problem with technology, burnout, moral distress, compassion fatigue, and shame, and all these things get in the way of empathy. So they see that I'm on their side. When I wrote another book called The Secret Language of Doctors, which was an expose of slang that's used to describe patients, and you wouldn't believe, for instance, bariatric patients who are dangerously obese, the slang terms that are used to describe them, they're referred to as whales and seals and a lot of expressions that are worse. Well, they didn't like that book. And they didn't like my TED Talk. Well, it's interesting.
They didn't like that book? Wow, fat chance.
No, they didn't like that
book
at all.
Fat chance they wouldn't like that.
Yeah, no, because it and you know they maybe they didn't like the newspaper coverage of the book because it said, you know, the headlines in the newspapers were you wouldn't believe what doctors are saying about you behind your back. But you know, after the slang, I unpacked the culture that from which the slang comes. And in fact, I was being very sympathetic to health professionals because, you know, for instance, why do surgeons find it difficult to operate on people who weigh 600 pounds? Because you have to get all that flesh out of the way to find the appendix to take it out. And maybe they don't have the right equipment. They don't have the right stretchers and the right chairs and the right wheelchairs and that are suitable for bariatric patients. And that was a call to the hospital to get better equipment. So I was, in fact, being sympathetic, but they didn't like that book. And the TED Talk is interesting.
Oh, did we lose him? We lost someone.
No, are you there? Yeah.
Who's there? Carrie?
Yes.
Are you going to talk
now?
There's Dr. Goldman. Can we hear you?
Yeah, I'm back.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
boy.
Right. Okay, so
you make a quick disappearance and you come back like David Copperfield. Carrie.
Yeah, and you know what? And that wasn't very nice of you to suggest that Carrie disappeared or that she was talking underwater when she was talking about Bartonella.
That's
weren't
right.
You? Did I hear that?
Yes. Thank you. A lot of people don't even know what that is.
So were you? Are we talking cat scratch disease?
Yes, we are talking. Most people don't understand or know what this is, and it's caused me a lot of issues the last almost 10 years. 6 have been the worst, but like chronic fatigue type symptoms.
Oh, yikes!
Brain fog. It's been terrible.
Was it recognized early, and were you treated right away with doxycycline or erythromycin?
No, and I was just recognized a few months ago, so I've been living with this for a long time, but I'll tell you, I stopped the antibiotics, unless, of course, I have a bad infection, I take it, but I was on so many antibiotics as a kid and through my young adulthood, it really screwed me up, my microbiome, my gut, everything. So then I got candida, and it was, I mean, I've been living in hell for about 20 years until I figured out how to get rid of the candida, and now I'm okay, but I just have this brain fog and tiredness. So I just got diagnosed a few months ago, and since then I've been taking measures to stop it, and one of them is an oxygen therapy from Cocoon in Hungary. And that leads me to my next question is, do you believe in integration into, you know, where the Western meets Eastern, or where there's different types of therapies that can work for people? Some doctors do, some doctors don't. I want to know why there is such a dissonance between like the two fields, and why there isn't more harmony.
All right. Well, that's a huge question. Both of you are in radio. Dr. Goldman is a radio host of White Coat Black Art, an amazing show. And Carrie, you've been a host for so many years. You know how fast radio goes by. We're already at the bottom of the hour. We have a half an hour left. We got to take a break. That's the way it is, guys. You know that. We are going to talk about, Carrie, it's an excellent question. We're going to ask Dr. Goldman after the break about the integration between Western medicine and what he spews out about the problems that we have in North America right now and Eastern medicine. And we're going to hear about it after the break. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC. Dr. Feel Good. Well, if we're going to accomplish anything in this hour, we're going to hear every song that ever mentioned the word doctor in it for the entire hour. And that's a tribute to all the great work that Dr. Brian Goldman has done, exposing some of the most important issues behind the scenes in emergency rooms and in doctors' offices, making for a better system. And soon we're going to get to the power of kindness, because that's really important. It's part of his work that is really poignant and something that we need to talk about. But before we get to the power of kindness, because Dr. Brian Goldman does look to the future to improve the system, he's not just complaining and bitching about everything. He actually has a method to his madness. We want to talk a little bit about what Carrie teased us about. So, Carrie, in your best lawyerly way, please, yes, in a very concise way, because the judge doesn't want to hear these long, drawn-out questions like Alan Gervie always asks. Go ahead and ask Dr. Goldman, so the people who weren't listening, and I don't know why they weren't, will hear what you asked him.
I just wanted to know about integrative medicine and using different methods and why Western doctors are, a lot of them, not all, opposed to it until you find somebody who does use more of an Eastern-Western kind of way that they deal with people, I guess you could say. And it doesn't even have to be Eastern. It could just be different methods that people find, what they call, like, maybe naturopath. What's the issue there?
Well, the issue is you know, for a long time, integrative medicine, complementary medicine, that's what it's sometimes called, was looked upon as benign. It was looked upon as you know, something that, as long as it doesn't harm the patient, you know, who am I to argue with it? I think that there have been some thought leaders in Canada. Tim Caulfield wrote a book called, you know, What If Gwyneth Paltrow Was Wrong About Everything. It was a Goop expose, and yeah. Jennifer Gunter has also written a book now, The Vagina Bible, and can you say that on your radio show?
Yes.
We say,
yes,
far
you
worse. You should hear the names,
yes,
I call Carrie. Go ahead.
Anyway, lately, some of the people who are leading the fight against naturopaths are concerned that naturopathic doctors are recommending homeopathy. And, you know, homeopathy, we could spend a long time explaining it, but basically, by definition, a homeopathic remedy has no active ingredient in it. So if it works because it's a placebo, and there is really not a lot of scientific evidence. So what these critics are trying to do is hold the practitioners of integrative medicine to account, just to make sure that what they're doing is not harmful, and is effective. And that becomes a particularly important question when people are being charged thousands of dollars for treatment that doesn't have a lot of basis in scientific research. And I certainly don't disagree with that.
That makes sense. It makes sense. But let me tell you something. I've been charged thousands of dollars and given so many different wrong whys with what's been going on, which has actually harmed me more. Why isn't that looked at, right? I have been harmed by how many antibiotics I have put on, which has destroyed my gut, destroyed my stomach, gave me all these different side effects. Why aren't we looking at that as well? And when I did turn to a different type of method, Hippocrates said, let food be thy medicine, right? Let food mm-hmm. be thy medicine. People have gone so far from that, eating, you know, crap and the toxins that they're putting in through diet and other ways, right? So I went to the regular medical, to my regular medical doctor, who I love, who's been fantastic, but constant antibiotics, which has now destroyed me. denied had to rebuild it with probiotics, different ways that are would be considered more naturopathic, and I'm now getting better. So what do you do when it's the Western medicine that's wrong and harming?
Well, and you know, have you heard of the old boys club? Unfortunately, there is a double standard here, and I think that you know, with the calls to hold alternative medicine to account, I think we have to hold Occidental, Western medicine, allopathic medicine, whatever you want to call it, to account as well. And that means that we should not be prescribing treatments that are heavily influenced by pharmaceutical companies, you know,
Amen
or have
to
a
that.
Bias. We should be declaring our bias, and we should, above all, as Hippocrates, good old Hippocrates said, do no harm.
Yes.
Right. That's very true. You know, such important stuff. I want to talk about something that really had an impact on me, because I'll never forget the name Mrs. Drucker. You know, you remember that patient. You might remember her.
I sure do.
Yeah. So I want to talk about Mrs. Drucker because it really was poignant. And for those of you who have not seen Dr. Brian Goldman's TED Talk, please see it because it's very important, very meaningful. Tell you a quick story, and I'll try and be quick about it. And I think Carrie's probably heard it before. 2011, I was playing softball. I had some pain in my kidney region. It was severe pain. I was taken to the hospital by ambulance. And I went thinking it was a kidney stone. They diagnosed a tumor. I was in the hospital for a few weeks, and I was bleeding, and I didn't have the strength to go under surgery. The night before, they finally said that I had to have the surgery, take the kidney out. The night before, they told me the tumor, it had spread everywhere through the whole cavity of my body, and that's how I faced September 19th, 2011, when I went into surgery thinking that I had a tumor all over my body. My whole family had gathered around the hospital at Cedars-Sinai.
Wow.
And I was lying there waiting for the doctor to come. The surgeon, the anesthesiologist, was standing there with a number of nurses and ready to put me under. The doctor ran into the room about 11 o'clock in the morning and said, stop, don't put that man under. Everyone stopped and said, what are you talking about? He said, well, we looked at another MRI and we had a different radiologist look at it. And she thinks that it's not a tumor. It's just a hematoma. And we shouldn't put him under the surgery.
Wow.
They wheeled me out of the operating room. I went into my room. I ripped out all the IVs that were in me. I put on my clothes. The discharge nurse came in and said, first time I'm discharging you with no prescriptions or no directions whatsoever. Called everyone and I said, I have a clean bill of health other than having a ball of blood that may have been caused by a ruptured kidney or bleed somewhere in my body. I regained my strength and moved on. Doctor.
Wow. What a story.
Yeah. First time the anesthesiologist said in 30 years that he had ever seen anything like that happen. That was at Cedars-Sinai.
Yeah. And I'll tell you something, Alan. That can happen in many different ways. One of the ways it can happen is, can you imagine if there were two women with a breast cancer biopsy report and their reports got switched, and one was reporting cancer and the other one was a clean report, just a benign cyst. Can you imagine? And that happens. That has happened where the wrong patient went under the knife. To everybody's eyes and ears, it was the right patient, but they had gotten the wrong biopsy report or the wrong scan report.
Things that are almost happen more often. And let's talk about the emergency room. Tell us quickly why I talked about Mrs. Drucker.
I talked about Mrs. Drucker because I was asked to see a patient in the emergency department. I was not the emergency physician. I was a resident on the cardiology service, and I saw her, and I did a workup. She had congestive heart failure, and I gave her medications to take the extra water off. She had fluid on her lungs. She was starting to feel better. But then I made a couple of mistakes. The first one was to not talk to my attending, who was her cardiologist, knew her for years. And the second was that I didn't listen to my own inner voice that said, you shouldn't send her home. And I overrode that. You know, the reason why I didn't talk to my attending was that I didn't want to be a high maintenance resident who asked my attending for everything. And I'm not defending that. That's what I did at the time. And so I discharged her. And later on that day, I found out that she came back to the emergency department near death, and she died about 10 days later. And that is one of the names and faces that wake me up at 4 o'clock in the morning and probably always will.
And we take your hat off, our hats off to you for talking about it, because so many people struggle with this. We are all human. And you can imagine what goes through doctors' minds like yourself, who, by the way, by all accounts, is one of the top ER doctors in the country in Canada. And you're able to talk about that. And I know it led you to this kind of adventure to find kindness in this world and how to find the empathy which could be injected into your own world and others' world. Now, you recently tweeted, if you have the choice of going for the jugular on Twitter or being kind, choose kind. You'll feel you'll feel much better. I just stopped myself from blowing a gasket, and I feel better. We want to talk about that after the break. We've got one more segment. Let's end, like we love to do on Gervie's Law, and I'm sure the goal and objective of White Coat Black Art, on positive notes to see what we can learn and how the future can be improved by the power of kindness. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC. Oh, my goodness.
Weird Al Yankovic.
Oh, boy. That's hitting close to home. After telling that story about my kidney, and now they're talking about cutting for the very first time. Well, let's turn this around. We're talking to Dr. Brian Goldman. And I want to ask you, Brian, because your book is so powerful, The Power of Kindness, Why Empathy is Essential in Everyday Life. And you went around looking for stories that you could relate to, the kindness around the world. Before we get to that, this is something that's just on my mind, because I was thinking about this with kindness, how we can conquer so many problems and obstacles. And then I think about, especially here in Canada, it's a little slower, not really Toronto, because Toronto's kind of like the United States, but in other parts of Canada, Winnipeg, where I grew up, you know, I got to tell you that it's slower. Here, it's such a fast-paced life, and there's so much stress. Being an attorney, I'm stressed all the time. Is that an obstacle to being kind? Because when you went around the world and you go to São Paulo or wherever it is and you see people on the streets being kind to each other, maybe they just don't have the stress that people like I do, and maybe they have the ability to be kinder. How do you overcome that?
Well, you know, you're asking the most important question that I tried to uncover in the book, Alan. The first thing that I have to say is that you and I, you know, unless we're psychopaths, we are hardwired to be kind. Evolution has made us kind, has made us empathic, has given us the ability to imagine what it's like to be someone else, and to have that inform our behavior and our actions. So for instance, you know, if I see a patient in the emergency department who's on a gurney and who's there for 3 or 4 days on that gurney because there's no bed in the hospital, you know, at some point I have to have an ability to imagine what it's like to be that patient on that stretcher with no privacy, with limited access to a bathroom, unwanted smells, unwanted conversations just, you know, coming by, you know, groups of doctors that are talking shop as they go by. And, you know, when I went searching for kindness, I found people who were kind. I think what they have in common are a few things. First of all, they have a way of getting away from the stress
that you were talking about. There's a lot of stress in urban life. There's a lot of stress in America right now from, you know, job insecurity and insecurity about the borders and, you know, food insecurity, insecurity about my place in society. And when you have that insecurity and stress to a heightened level, what happens is that your natural ability to be kind and empathic kind of melts away, and it's replaced by this instinctive behavior where we're constantly looking, are you on my team or are you on the other guy's team? Us and them. And if you think that person you're looking at, and we make these decisions in our brains in nanoseconds, it's automatic. We can't afford